I'd like to welcome you to the this afternoon's panel on the problems in the financial sector. We have a large number of panelists who are going to speak to us to get this kicked off, and each one is going to speak for 5 minutes, and it's my job to make good on that promise. Designated as moderator, I feel a little bit like the impartial referee at a meeting of the Christians and Lions. I'm not sure, but I'm going to do my best to keep these in line. Now, the credentials of our speakers are unsurpassed, and they're available to you in writing, so we're going to spend essentially no time I'm telling you where they were, where they went to school, but I assure you they all went to school. I will tell you their present affiliations for what that's worth and the order in which we're going to hear from them. We're going to hear first from Peter Wallison, who's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and is over there at the far end. And then from Bert Ely, the chairman of Ely & Company Consulting. And from John Taylor of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. And on my immediate left, Professor Todd Zwicky, George Mason University School of Law. Then we'll hear from Alex Pollack, also at the American Enterprise Institute, from Andrew Redleaf, White Box Advisors, and from Scott Polakoff from the Office of Thrift Supervision within the Department of the Treasury. With that said, I'm going to start the stopwatch. There are a few people here old enough to remember a TV game show called Beat the Clock, in which each contestant was given some absurd task to perform, such as, you know, an egg and spoon walk and that sort of thing, before the clock ran out. And we're going to ask each of our speakers in 5 minutes to tell us what's happened, why, and what should be done about it. Peter, it's all yours. As you like.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's a pleasure to be here. Actually, I'm still going to school on what we're facing in this economy. I'm learning every day, and I'm not sure that what I'm going to say today is my final view on the subject, but we have simply an extraordinary event unfolding, series of events unfolding before our eyes, and we can all learn a tremendous amount by thinking carefully about what this all means. As a person who deals with policy, tries to at least, I want to make sure that we understand what the essence of this is. The diagnosis of where we are and how we got here is exceedingly important because it's the diagnosis that produces what is ultimately the prescription. So I hope you will all be thinking about how we got here and what you hear from the other people on the panel, because that is really what we have to do. And I'm going to advance some ideas about what I think caused the problem we are in, and hope I can do it within the now 4.5 minutes that I've been given by His Honor. Let me say that my general view is that the problem we are facing today is almost entirely the result of government policy. There are, as I identify it, 5 major elements that have made the financial condition worse today than anyone might have expected, but only because government policy forced it into positions that has forced our economy into positions that it would not have been in had that government policy not existed. The first, there are 5 of them, and the first of those, of course, is that the government has attempted to get more housing in this country, expand home ownership, but it has not done it in the honest way that governments should do it. I have no quarrel with that policy, because there are great exogenous benefits that come from housing more people, or more people owning homes. But it did it in a dishonest way. Instead of providing for some kind of subsidy so that people who could not otherwise afford to get into the mortgage world and buy a home, it used the financial system to manipulate that issue. It used CRA with banks, and it used Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, forcing both of them, in the case of National Bank CRA and the case of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, rules concerning making affordable housing loans that in fact created a bit of a competition to acquire subprime and Alt-A loans, driving down, in a very real sense, the risk premium that would normally go with those loans and making it appear as though those loans were not as risky as they actually are. We now have trillions of dollars of those loans scattered through our banking system, through the banking systems of the rest of the world, and that is the central reason why there is concern about the stability and the quality of the assets, maybe even the solvency, of many of our largest banks and many of the banks around the world. The second point is that this CRA and to some extent Fannie and Freddie's operations caused a real change in the quality of underwriting for loans. In order to acquire these loans from people who were not otherwise able to meet down payment standards and others, many new ideas, flexible ideas, were developed for mortgage lending. Interest-only loans, adjustable-rate loans, negative amortization, no income test, FICO score alone being the sole reason you might make a loan. All of those things tended to depreciate, if you will, the quality of underwriting for mortgages and reduced the quality of those mortgages and reduced the equity, especially the question of lower down payments. It reduced the equity that was behind a mortgage when someone bought a home. The third element was an option to refinance, which is allowed in our law almost everywhere. This is an unusual thing. It's not something that it's a natural right, but you don't always have an option to refinance without paying a premium. And we have in our law an option to refinance, which enabled people, whenever interest rates went down, to refinance or housing prices went up, to refinance their homes and draw out of those homes whatever equity they had already accumulated, which was used to buy a boat or whatever else, a second home perhaps, whatever else it was that they wanted. So that reduced the actual equity in homes behind the mortgage. The fourth policy was a tax policy which allowed interest on home equity loans to be deductible. Now, as you know, unless you're in business, the interest that you pay on a borrowing is not tax deductible. But if you're a homeowner and you have equity in your home, you can borrow against that and use it to buy that boat. And many, many people did that and, again, reduced whatever equity they were able to accumulate in their homes so that all the homes that are owned in the United States, or a very large number of them, don't have any support for the debt that has been placed on those homes by a mortgage. And finally, the fifth and I think final one I will talk about, although there are probably many more, the fifth is bank regulation. Under Basel I, which is still in force for many, many banks and hasn't been fully implemented here in the United States for the larger institutions, banks were required to hold only 4% capital against their mortgages, whereas they have to hold 8% capital against a commercial loan, which, of course, gives them an incentive to hold more mortgages than they might ordinarily and make more mortgages than they might ordinarily. Again, a policy not only of the United States, but many countries that signed on to that. In addition, if you turn your mortgages into a set of mortgage-backed securities, you only have to hold 20% of the capital requirement, which is usually 8%, behind your mortgage-backed securities. That means you're really holding 1.6% in capital behind a portfolio of mortgage-backed securities. So you see what's happening here. The equity behind the home loan has been drawn out of the homes. The equity in the banks, which used to come from capital requirements for banks, has gradually been drawn out of the banks by government policies in regulation of banks. And as a result, we have very little equity or capital in a system that is intended to protect the solvency of mortgages and even the solvency of banks based on the equities that were behind them. So that's the cause of the problem, and it is solely the result, I think, of various governmental policies and others I could mention. So that's the diagnosis. Now we get to the prescription, and that I'll leave to all of my colleagues. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Bert Ely, and I'm very glad to be with you here today. You're going to hear from me some of what Peter said, and I'm going to go beyond it in some other ways. What I'm drawing my remarks from a paper that I'm working on. In fact, I have a few copies with me if some people would like to get to comment on it, called Bad Rules Produce Bad Outcomes. And it's going to address the underlying public policy causes of the U.S. housing finance crisis. The key thing I do in this paper is talk about what I call the collision between the physics of finance and human nature. And what I do in this paper first is identify five human characteristics, five aspects of human nature that have become particularly relevant with regard to the housing finance crisis. I'm just going to list those very briefly and then touch on, so far, 11 causes that I've identified of this crisis that lie in the public sector. First of all, people's human nature for people to try to arbitrage the rules of the game. And the more complex the rules are, the more arbitraging there would be. And if there's ever an area of complex rules, it is in finance and in banking. The second is that people try to profit from a positive sloping yield curve. That is, short-term interest rates are usually lower than long-term interest rates. That ultimately is what set us up for the S&L crisis back in the 80s, and that has been a factor in this. The third is over-extrapolating trends. House prices are going to go on forever. They'll never come back. The stock market will go up and up and up, or, as we may now say, down, 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 and down. And then from that comes herd behavior, which we have certainly seen in the housing area. And finally, an excessive reliance on expert opinions, such as those offered by the rating agencies. So what I offer in this paper in looking at these 11 causes are, if you will, solutions, policy recommendations that build on those characters, those aspects of human behavior that we have to recognize. Now, what do I see as these causes? First of all, the Internal Revenue Code. And not just on the housing side, as Peter talked about, but also on the corporate side, we have a tax system that encourages overconsumption, discourages savings, it encourages over-leveraging by both households and businesses, and under-encourages the accumulation of equity capital that is non-debt capital. And consequently, we have an over-leveraged society both in the business sector, the banking sector, and the household sector, which is why we're in the problems we are and always end up in problems anytime you have a downturn in asset values. Second of all, as Peter also touched on, is banking regulation, particularly very detailed prescriptive and proscriptive regulation. Some will argue that the cause of this crisis is the financial deregulation of recent decades. First of all, I'd like to have people tell me exactly what that was. But we still have a very highly regulated banking system, financial system than we've had before, which created a lot of incentives for people to try and arbitrage around the system, creating what I call the world of shadow banking, that is credit intermediation outside the banking system. Third, we have policies that discourage maturity mismatching, which is particularly important in terms of providing stability in financing long-term fixed assets like home mortgages. Fourth is fair value accounting. Fifth is the fact that many credit default swaps are increasingly seen as a problem, oftentimes don't have an insurable interest behind them, and I would argue that that's really nothing more than gambling. And a question should be raised is whether a credit default swap is enforceable if there is no insurable interest. Sixth is mispriced deposit insurance, specifically in terms of an underpricing for risk that banks have accumulated. And, of course, a lot of the bank failures today are among banks that were excessive in their risk-taking. The seventh is the First Amendment protection for the credit rating agencies, that they can't be sued for negligence. The accounting firms give opinions. They get sued. Some of them even go bankrupt. The same should hold for the rating agencies. The eighth are the government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie, Freddie, particularly that Peter talked about. The ninth, and there are many, many aspects, is the over-promotion of home ownership. For a long time, the home ownership percentage in this country was around 64%. In recent years, it got pushed up to 69%, and that's when we saw the outburst of subprime lending. As one who is a longtime confirmed renter, I frankly am getting tired of being treated as a second-class citizen because I have voluntarily decided not to own a home. I hire good landlords. I think we need to be more respective of rent. Tenth is the Glass-Steagall Act, and the 11th is monetary policy. And there are a couple of others that I have been thinking about, one of which is, in many states, non-recourse obligations on the part of homeowners who default on their mortgages. With that, I will close it off. I look forward to our discussion and your questions. Thank you.
So the title of...
good afternoon.
The title of Burt's paper, and I love Burt, but the title, Bad Rules Produce Bad Outcomes. And I read the paper. I think there's a lot of good things in it. But it helped me with create my title for my paper, Bad Rules Don't Produce Bad Outcomes, Bad People Do. And to borrow, I'm really borrowing that from the Second Amendment advocates, you know, guns don't kill people, people kill people. So, you know, for me, it wasn't the rules and regulations relative to our economy, but it was those people again who killed our economy. Those folks in the private financial services sector who abandoned, or perhaps some of them who never had any ethical standards to begin with, that led the mortgage industry down a path that promoted and encouraged deceptive and predatory lending. The regulatory agencies, more people, charged with ensuring fairness and ethical standards and safety and soundness in our lending system, failed in their responsibilities. It was actually sad for me to watch former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan being grilled by members of Congress for his free market assumptions. In the end, a humbled Mr. Greenspan admitted that he had put too much faith in the self-correcting power of the free markets and had failed to anticipate the self-destructive power of wanton mortgage lending. Quote, those of us who have looked to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity, myself included, are in a state of shock disbelief. Those segments of the mortgage industry that led us on this path to disaster were actually two of the most underregulated, non-transparent, and unaccountable segments of the entire mortgage industry, independent mortgage companies and Wall Street institutions. The independent mortgage companies operated with little or no regulatory oversight. The Community Reinvestment Act did not apply to them. And by the way, depending on whose statistics you want to look at, whether it's the Federal Reserve or others, you'll see between 83 to 85, as much as 90 in some studies that show the loans that are now problematic, these high costs that are going into foreclosure and are causing problems, were not CRA-generated loans. They were not done by CRA institutions. I'm surprised AEI doesn't understand this. Perhaps the story will change on this. But the folks who did this, we obviously know were not the typical banks and folks who were the mainstay of the mortgage industry at one time. So these independent mortgage companies could market almost unimpeded, as history has shown us, one product after another to minority neighborhoods and another product to white neighborhoods. Banks were more scrutinized in this matter, and there's one of the reasons why banks were relatively slow to embrace the subprime lending with its multiple layering. When they did follow the independent mortgage companies down the path to the spurious lending, they did so via their subsidy institutions, again, most of which were outside the purview of the Community Reinvestment Act and its examiners. Complex and sophisticated instruments or derivatives allowed for leveraging credit based on the layering of risk supported by an assumption of a never-ending housing value inflation. Mortgage lending, one of the cleanest and safest loans made by the financial service sector historically, had its performance horizon revised from 30 years to 3 months. Lenders who worried about the long-term portfolio performance would be replaced by those who needed to have the borrower survive and make payments only for a few months. Short-term fees replaced long-term payoffs as the business model for the mortgage industry. The pipeline for such behavior was expanded by the investment banks flush with capital in search of any investment. Regulation? What regulation? To be fair, there are other collaborators in this free market gone wild. Property appraisers did their part by adjusting property values according to lender, broker, and seller desires rather than simply using their independent evaluations, processes, and systems. In return, the appraiser got their fee and more business from that broker or lender. While the law required independence and arm's-length transactions between appraisers and lenders, nearly 95% of all appraisers have admitted that they were regularly influenced to adjust home evaluations by the broker or the lender. In many instances, the mortgage companies like Countrywide Home Mortgage own the appraisal company that they used. Independent mortgage brokers drove much of the malfeasant lending train, and in most states, getting a license to offer mortgages was as easy as procuring a driver's license. Requirements relating to brokers' their own financial condition, credit history, criminal history, business history, and prior legal problems were non-existent in most states. Education courses were offered, many online, and with little to no continuing education. In most states, while brokers could be licensed in that state, they didn't need to have their principal business in that state. Almost no state gave brokers a duty of responsibility to secure and offer loans that were reasonably advantageous to the borrower. Few states had meaningful enforcement authority available that would have allowed them to rein in unscrupulous brokers. Regulation, no regulation, where art thou? Mortgage lenders knowingly collaborated with these appraisers and brokers to push mortgages, layered with risk upon risk and with less documentation on borrowers' financial ability, assessing the borrower's ability to repay the loan only for the first 2 or 3 years, after which time the loan features reset. At loan closings, lenders had borrowers sign documents on that day reveal a negative amortization and promise the borrower that home equity appreciation was a sure thing and the road to salvation out of the current loan was via refinancing when rates would be lower and your property value greater. All this they promised would occur in less than 2 years. This is how you build wealth sooner. This is how everybody is doing it. They assured the nervous borrowers. Why buy the home? In fact, many instances we found it actually encouraged borrowers to take out a larger loan for a larger home and encourage them to go look for something more than what they were even originally coming into the lender for. So regulation or regulation, where art thou? And let us not dismiss the role of the rating agencies that willingly slap AAA and AA and other ratings on these securities, implying a level of integrity and due diligence, even though such decisions were based solely upon the representations of the lender, the institution paying for the rating agency services. We believe these rating agencies substantially contributed to the housing and foreclosure crisis in African American and Latino communities by making public misrepresentations about the soundness and reliability of these subprime securities. Regulation or regulation, we're at now. Finally, we have the investment banks telling the entire mortgage industry to paraphrase and distort Emma Lazarus's great historic line, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free." Instead, from Wall Street investment firms, we got, "Give me your pay option arms, your no doc, your low documentation pile of poorly unwritten loans. Send me the wretched refuge of your teeming origination process. Send all these and more to me." And in the end, we continue to learn several lessons from the mortgage meltdown. Chief among them is that there is a nexus between safe and sound lending and abusive lending. When greed and malfeasance are able to dominate the business sector, and when middle-class and moderate-income lending abuses are ignored, we all lose. Today, the main culprits have sealed their own demise with all the major independent mortgage companies gone. Meritcrest, Option One, New Century, Countrywide. So, too, are many of the major investment banks either gone or reduced. I'm going to leave out my stuff about Phil Graham because I'm running out of time. We can talk about him on another time, but I do want to say, I close by just saying, you know, in The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith tackled the question, what makes an economy grow? He spoke to the need of a free market with liquidity and free trade, but he was also emphatic about the rule of law, that there must be present rule of law that ensures the fairness and integrity of the market. Alan Greenspan, in his latest book, Age of Turbulence, reputation and trust it fosters has always appeared to me to be the core required attributes of market capitalism. The rule of law and trust were missing from the subprime mortgage lending industry during the years 2003 to 2007, when the majority of these deceptive and predatory loans were allowed to pollute the American mortgage market. Still today, Congress has not acted to outlaw these practices, and we're hoping that in the next administration we'll address this. I look forward to more discussion during the Q&A. Sorry for taking too much time.
We wouldn't allow that. Well, we certainly live in historic times, by which I mean in the final month of the Bush administration, the Washington Post has finally found a cabinet official that they like. Hank Paulson being praised for putting aside his closed-minded ideology and waking up to the real world and being more pragmatic in tackling the world as opposed to being a slave to free market views. But we're also in historic times, obviously, with respect to the financial crisis. And I used to refer to this as the subprime crisis, but the more I explore it, it's more really just a mortgage crisis sort of situation. And what I'm going to talk about just briefly is sort of three theories of foreclosure, what's going on, and in particular what they tell us about the possibility for unintended consequences with respect to interventions in the mortgage market, because what we'll see is these three different theories cut at cross purposes sometimes. And the three basic theories are, one, problems of local macroeconomic distress. Second is the particular problems we have with adjustable rate mortgages. And the third is what we can think of as a negative equity problem, or what we can think of as a put option with respect to how consumers use the option to allow default and foreclosure. And basically, it turns out if you look at how consumers actually behave over the long run and, you know, sort of in the aggregate, they behave quite rationally, which tells us something and warns us against the way we want to intervene. So the first problem we have is basically local macroeconomic distress. This causes foreclosures. The earliest surge in the foreclosure problem this time came from Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana, basically where we've had longstanding macroeconomic problems. Whenever we have a natural disaster, that leads to foreclosures. Now, one thing that's interesting about that is that when homes are underwater, people are reluctant to move and relocate. So one unintended consequence, if we say try to prevent foreclosures as a good in itself, may be setting back the need for labor market mobility and the flexibility of people to move around in the economy. So sometimes foreclosure does involuntarily what people don't want to do voluntarily, which is basically give up their house and move to a part of the country where the economy is growing and they can get a better job. Second theory is basically adjustable rate mortgages. And I've brought some handouts that didn't get handed out. So I'll just hold this up and maybe the camera can pick it up a little bit. But basically what this shows is over time, this is the trend. The top line is fixed rate mortgages and the bottom line is adjustable rate mortgages on sort of an aggregate sort of thing. What you notice is a couple things. First, there's a general downward trend since 1984. Second, what you notice is that, in general, there's about a 100 to 150 basis point difference between adjustable rate mortgages and fixed rate mortgages. What does that mean? Basically, what it means, if you get a fixed rate mortgage, you have to pay the bank to bear the risk of interest rate fluctuations. Adjustable rate mortgages, you bear the risk. Now, what does that mean? Well, that's on average. Over time, however, we get these divergences between short-term interest rates and long-term interest rates. And what we see is that consumers respond to those incentives, which is that as the spread between short-term interest rates and long-term interest rates increase, people flip from fixed-rate mortgages to adjustable-rate mortgages. This is a scenario that predates anything involving the subprime mortgages. If you look at this chart, basically what you see is that in 1984, for instance, 61% of the mortgages that were written in 1984 were adjustable rate mortgages. In 1988, they were 58%. In 1992, it was about 50%, right? Consumers respond to the differences between adjustable rate mortgages and fixed rate mortgages. So why has this not been a problem in the past? Well, the reason it hasn't been a problem in the past is that in the past, the general trend was adjustable rate mortgages and short-term interest rates would drop below fixed rate mortgages, and fixed rate mortgages would come down to the adjustable rate over time. What happened this last time, though, of course, was Federal Reserve pushed adjustable short-term interest rates very low, artificially low. Fixed rate mortgages stayed flat, and what happened is instead of fixed rate coming down, adjustable rate went back up, and all of a sudden we've got an adjustable rate mortgage crisis. It's not just a subprime crisis. So that if you look at the data, this is subprime mortgages. What the top line is adjustable rate mortgages for subprime. What you see is they take off over the past 2 years. If you can see the bottom line, which is fixed rate subprime mortgages, that line is basically flat. Fixed rate subprime mortgages have not exhibited the same sort of problems as adjustable rate mortgages. Now, partly that's because subprime borrowers who got fixed rate mortgages were marginally better risk than those who got adjustable rate. But what you see is that we've got an ARM problem when it comes to subprime mortgages. Not a hybrid problem, though. It's not the problem of the short-term opening thing, because the best empirical evidence we have, that's not the problem, because those mortgages tended to refinance. But if you look at the prime rate mortgages, you see the same thing. Prime mortgages have behaved the same way as subprime, which is we've got an ARM problem when it comes to to prime mortgages. So what you see is that foreclosures on prime adjustable rate mortgages have risen 300% over the past couple of years. Fixed rate prime mortgages have been basically flat. So we do have something that is an adjustable rate problem. In and of itself, ARMs aren't the problem. The problem is you put an ARM together with the monetary policy we had from 2000 to 2004, and you get the problem that that we have today. The United States is unique in having, as Peter suggested, the rest of the world has adjustable rate mortgages of 10 to 15-year duration with no right to prepay. Right? The United States is unique in the kind of mortgages that we offer, so there's nothing inherently, I think, problematic with ARMs. It's just when you get this problem. The final theory is basically the idea of a put option or negative equity when it comes to homes. And basically the idea here is that if you're, that consumers can think of the option of default and foreclosure as a put option. If the house goes down in value such that it's worth less than the mortgage, consumers have the option of either continuing to pay the mortgage or give it back to the bank. Now, what we know is that the places that have seen the highest foreclosure rates are also the places that have seen the largest drop in home prices. So that basically, and what we see is that the rise in foreclosures has basically matched the timing of the fall in home prices. So what we have is people basically calculating, is it worth it to me to continue paying the loan when I'm $100,000 underwater, or do I walk away? Now, what we also know is that the value of that option is affected by either the cost or the benefit of exercising the option. So that, for instance, the reason why, a major reason why California and Arizona are huge outliers in the foreclosure rates, is because they have non-recourse laws there. And there is a huge body of empirical evidence that shows that the easier it is to foreclose, the less the cost of an anti-deficiency law is being that you can only, the bank can only take the house back and can't sue for a deficiency. What we know is we've got a lot of empirical evidence that says that leads to foreclosures at three or four times, triple or quadruple the foreclosure rate when house prices go down, which raises the question in my mind at least, which is if the problem is California and Arizona's absurd laws involving debtor collection laws, why is it my problem? Why is it Washington's problem instead of Sacramento's problem, I think is a threshold question I have. And why are we bribing people? Basically what we're saying is that if we're going to persuade those people not, we're going to bribe them into not walking away from their homes. That's sort of a weird sort of problem, right? So anyway, we've got these three problems, the ARMs and the walk-away problem, the put option. Obviously, dovetail, we've got things tied up together, but it just shows the complexity of this problem and the possibility for unintended consequences that might arise from it. Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, the bubble was huge, and as we all know, we are mired in a terrific bust with all kinds of asset prices plummeting, famous financial firms failing, credit contracting, and bailouts bloating the government's balance sheet. In fact, we're in an extended financial panic. As described by David Ricardo two centuries ago, quote, on extraordinary occasions, a general panic may seize the country. When everyone becomes desirous of possessing himself of the precious metals, don't do that anymore, now it's cash and treasury bills. Ricardo continues, against such panic, Banks have no security on any system, unquote. We all know that no bank, even the most solvent bank, can survive a run, and a financial system made up of leveraged financial firms can equally not survive a run. And this lack of security for leveraged financial firms against a generalized panic on any system, as Ricardo says, is what triggers government intervention of various kinds, including government deposit guarantees, so-called insurance, and bailouts. Now, the bubble, while it's on, is characterized by greatly increased debt and leverage. A period of success leads to the belief by all parties, financial actors, regulators, politicians, theorists, and commentators, that greater leverage, and especially the use of short-term debt, is safe. Of course, it turns out, in the end, that pushed to an extreme, it isn't. And when the bust comes, everybody tries to de-lever, as we say these days, which means to reduce debt and reduce the ratio of debt to leverage. Ask yourself this question. How is it possible for everybody to delever, for all balance sheets to shrink at the same time? Imagine that the entire financial system is one big balance sheet, and ask yourself, how can that aggregate balance sheet shrink in the aggregate? And you will come to the conclusion that it can't, at least it can't without an asset price collapse and widespread debt deflation. So if the need of the private balance sheets to shrink is to be confirmed, some other balance sheet has to expand. That's the government's balance sheet. And this yin and yang between these two balance sheets, the private balance sheet delevering in a panic and the government balance sheet expanding in a panic, is what, of course, we observe. This is why the Federal Reserve balance sheets, if we add all the Federal Reserve banks together, have increased from about $860 billion to over $2 trillion. It's why we have the TARP program and all these other interventions. It's why we have, in particular, one bailout I want to mention, which is the bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which is, of course, not an intervention in the private sector, but an intervention to save a government intervention. Namely, Fannie and Freddie, an intervention, respectively, of 1938 and 1970, which didn't go away. We can hope that these other interventions will be temporary and will be reversed in time, because they all, of course, every intervention brings with it expanded government and, in particular, bureaucratic power. My favorite example of an intervention which did go away was the Homeowners Loan Corporation of the 1930s, whose authorizing legislation, by the way, which took 3.5 pages of statutory text, I give that to all of you as a good example, concluded the directors shall proceed to liquidate the corporation when its purposes have been achieved. And they did, unlike Fannie and Freddie. A second thing to be hoped for in these interventions is that the taxpayers who are being made into involuntary investors in the equity of financial firms and in distressed debt will be thought of and treated like investors to the greatest extent possible. I even have the notion that if the various bailout schemes like the TARP succeed in making a profit, which it's my view that they may, very well may, 100% of that profit should be returned to those citizens who actually do pay federal income taxes as a dividend, 100% of it. I'm giving this as the last word. Men's spirits are lifted when the times are prosperous, rich, and happy, so that their pride and arrogance grow. Adversity chastens them and teaches them what should be done, but good fortune, which leads them to rejoice, usually makes them stray from right counsels and clear thinking. That was true when Cato the Elder wrote it in the 2nd century B.C., and it's true of bubbles and busts today. Thank you.
This is a somewhat unusual circumstance for me. Normally, when I'm in a room full of lawyers, half of them want me to shut up and be very guarded in what I say, and the other half want me to be loose-lipped. Everything the panel has said so far on housing, I basically agree with, and I think is true, except for Bert's comment on CDS. But it's all ancient history. It was last year's problem. It's still a problem, but we had a housing problem, and now we have a full-fledged financial crisis. That happened in September, pretty much with the failure of Lehman. If you look at a graph of any sort of measure of financial conditions, the beginning of September, we were bouncing along sort of the tightest they'd ever been in modern history. Maybe or maybe not tighter than 98 in the center of the long-term capital crisis, but tighter than September of 2001 after 9/11, tighter than 2002, Enron, WorldCom, Telecom bust, tighter than 87, that crash. Lehman was allowed to fail, and credit, the few sort business credit, consumer credit. There are actually a few holes, but business credit completely seized up and dried up. And currently, less than 100 enterprises in America can seamlessly refinance their debt. The market price for sort of everybody else is over 20%, probably 35%. A level, you know, that no enterprise can pay and nobody can lend at with the expectation of being paid back. Yesterday, AAA commercial-backed mortgages traded at over 20%, which means the fair market value of every building in a commercial building in America, the right cap rate is about 24%, 25%, 26%, up in cap rate, down in value from about 7. Every single building in America is underwater at fair market prices. And if the situation persists, every single building in America will change title from its current owners to some group of creditors. There's a massive sort of credit deflation going on, and that's the problem. It's no longer housing. Now, allowing Lehman to fail is, I think, by consensus viewed as a terrible mistake. So it wasn't really something that happened in isolation. Bear came upon Bear Stearns came upon problems in March. Maybe a classic run on the bank, maybe a solvency issue, who knows, but what is known is that, you know, sort of most important to Treasury. Treasury really wanted the Bear Stearns done at $2 a share instead of $10 a share, because somebody had to be punished. Shareholders have to reap their just deserts. And far be it, you know, that all the employees lose, you know, 92% of their total net worth, you know, really might not get the lesson home. It should be 98 or 99, or 100. And that was what was required to swage the gods of moral hazard. Government then sort of tells everybody that, first of all, Bear had a book value of $89 the day it was the deal was sealed or the day they had failed, a number sort of certified and supported by the officers of the company under Sarbanes-Oxley, but also actively or passively by the Securities and Exchange Commission, any one of a number of regulators, none of whom have been sort of called to account for that. But shareholders have to be punished, and $2 would have been better than $10, but but we did 10. So now, government tells the private markets, you know, recapitalize, raise money. Problem isn't that severe. In Bear's case, there are only $30 billion worth of assets, 7 or 8, 10% of their balance sheet that are questionable, that we don't really know. Government will take that. Government might make money on them. Recapitalize the system. And private market responded, buying $400 million of preferred stock from financial institutions. And it had to really be preferred stock because companies didn't need more debt, and also we know that equity gets wiped out. So private market came up with sort of the only solution, something in between. Fannie and Freddie are nationalized, and that $400 billion, the financial institutions, as a matter of policy choice, was wiped out. That was what was required to assuage the gods of moral hazard. A week later, Lehman comes, and it's not only preferred shareholders, but it's bondholders and counterparties, because that's what moral hazard requires. About face a week later, when AIG comes along, because certainly if AIG had been allowed to fail, Merrill and Morgan, and most importantly Goldman Sachs, surely would have gone too. And that was sort of too much. AIG is first rescued very punitively, and then about face, you know, sort of with the TARP and the preferreds offered to financial institutions. But we're still in a mode of the objective of policies is to punish the bad people, or you know, if so. Bailout of the auto industry. If you're left-wing, we can't do it because the executives have to be punished. They came to Washington in 3 separate private jets. They wasted $60,000. You know, bad optics, but completely irrelevant. If you're right-wing, the auto industry can't be bailed out because that would be a sop to the Obama supporting unionists. Basically the gods of moral hazard, I would submit, have been assuaged enough. We now actually have to stop worried about making micro mistakes, you know, picking winners and losers in the overall winners and losers among sort of specific companies, and we have to stop what is a massive credit deflation. Inflation was a government policy. Deflation is a government policy. It's not a matter of free market or not. We have to get beyond blame and keep the dollar from massive and prevent, you know, sort of the unorderly transfer of every asset in the country from current holders to debt holders.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Scott Polakoff. I'm a regulator who's been examining banks and thrifts for 25 years, and if you want to know what a human pinata might feel like, sit in my chair for the day. This is the first time I've been here, and I think I've been subject to a little rookie hazing by my colleagues up here, because we got together and we all chatted about our approach for today, and at the end of our chat, everybody was locked into the notion that we were going to sit in our chairs and give our presentations. And that was the way I was prepared to do it. And lo and behold, we're all standing up at the podium. I could go on forever. Okay, so where are we? I wanted to share with you some thoughts. They're going to be pretty high level since I only have 4 minutes left. And then I hope the Q&A is robust. What's rather interesting is right now the past due or the delinquency rate in the mortgage world is less than 10%. It's actually less than 9%. When you hear about the meltdown in the mortgage market, I submit to you the delinquency rate is less than 9%. Compare and contrast it to the Depression when the delinquency rate was in excess of 50%. But let's talk about this delinquency, because when I first started 25 years ago, and I started in Tulsa, Oklahoma, bought my first house in 1983, interest rate was 13.5%. Right? Times were different. Everybody knows what the prime rate was at that point in time. I sold it 6 years later and had to come to the closing table with a check for 20% of my purchase price. We are not in times that have never been seen before. It's how we handle it. Now, the delinquencies that I wanted to chat about, it used to be a loan went delinquent primarily for three reasons. There was a health issue, there was a divorce, there was a loss of job. So we kind of put that into one bucket. That I would capture as the ability to pay bucket. Now, what's rather interesting is we have a new subset of the ability to pay bucket, and that is the product that was underwritten for the borrower. Because now we have borrowers who did not have a divorce, did not lose their job, have no health issues, have the same cash flow program that they had when they got the original mortgage, but the product is a toxic product and had such a rate adjustment that these borrowers no longer have the ability to pay. So we have ability to pay bifurcated into those two categories. Now, what's interesting is recently we also have this notion of willingness to repay. And the willingness to repay, which was mentioned earlier and much more eloquent than I can possibly discuss it, is this concept of home price depreciation, where indeed borrowers who have the ability to repay are making a business decision that they no longer wish to repay because the depreciation associated with their property will never be recovered in their lifetime. So these are the kind of issues we need to walk through. I titled my presentation Whenever the Psychology of Human Paranoia Comes into Play, Uncertainty Rules the Day, because that's what we have here. I want to mention for a moment the securitization world, and primarily the private label securitization world, because what the securitization world did, the private label securitization world, is it took a product and it allowed bankers to not be concerned about the risk associated with the product. It allowed the bankers to not focus on ability to repay because those products were sliced and diced and sold to a group of investors, and the credit risk was immediately removed from the lender's books. That concept, I would submit to you, is somewhat aligned with the concept of having too much liquidity in the marketplace. That drives these kind of products. I would also ask you to accept the notion that many entities underwrote these products that were not regulated, mortgage brokers, mortgage companies, and others, and we have to be sure in a prospective fashion that we establish a level playing field, because when there are certain standards that the federal regulators, at least in the banking world, believe are appropriate, there's still a large universe right now of underwriters that are not subject to those requirements. Let me share with you a couple other items, and then I'll sit down and listen for the questions. Risk layering is a concept that needs to be addressed. And let's talk quickly about the notion of no-doc loans or low-doc loans. And many people, especially now, shake their head and say, what a horrible product. Well, when the product was introduced, it was not a horrible product. When the product was introduced, it was introduced for the concept of a refinancing product, which allowed the borrower who had been making payments timely for 60 or 70 months to be able to refinance and save 50 or 60 basis points without having to document all of the information, because first and foremost, the most important thing is ability to repay. It was demonstrated. But what happened and typically happens in the business world is a good product becomes an abusive product if there's not sufficient guidelines in place. Let me also say that consumers share the blame. Consumers had negative saving rates over the last couple years and were using their homes like ATMs. So there is plenty of blame to go around for everyone. Also, I would submit to you that CRA was not a cause of this problem. And the reason I say that, and I'm speaking as a regulator in saying that, is CRA and CRA loans are always expected to be done in a safe and sound manner. There is no regulator that allows a loan to be underwritten to a low and moderate income individual unless it's a safe and sound loan. At least that's the way it's supposed to work. I'm a little concerned about accounting. There are some accounting aspects that trouble me a little bit. I guess the notion is accounting should reflect but not drive economic reality. And I think within the fair market world, we have an opportunity to chat about that a little bit. And lastly, there should be some parts of the regulatory world that are counter-cyclical, not pro-cyclical. So whether it is, for example, the necessity to increase capital during the good times to prepare for the bad, or increase an allowance for loan and lease loss in the good times to prepare for the bad, I think that counter-cyclical approach has a lot of merit. Thank you very much.
Well, there's a lot on the table. We're going shortly, not yet, to open this to your questions. Before we do that, though, I want to allow a little bit of crosstalk. Again, some of you may recall this was on Saturday Night Live during the early 80s when we had a run of problems. A skit involving representatives of labor, of industry, of agriculture, of government, and so on, playing a panel game called Pass the Buck. Each one had 1 minute to explain why it was the next one's problem. We've had two different perspectives, actually two positive, favorable perspectives on the Community Reinvestment Act, and at least one, maybe two negative ones. I'll let that issue be joined by itself. You don't need a provocateur for that. Although I'm interested in John Taylor's attempt to explain a variable by reference to a constant, namely greed. Putting that aside, the panel has focused primarily on causes, which I think has been a very useful exercise, and less on prescriptions, leaving us some time for that. Peter Wallison, you were predicting this in 2004 and 2005. I reread your articles recently, predicting it with a level of precision that makes him a rather frightening person to be around. So my question to you to get us started on the next phase is, what should we do in view of this? Your point was to examine the causes carefully so that the response is tailored to that. We have some different views on causes, but actually a lot of convergence as well. What are you going to tell us about the prescription? In particular, we've seen the government propose and execute more proposals than executions, several different responses in the space of a mere couple of months. There's some suggestion that that vacillation is itself aggravating the situation. But putting aside the problem of inconstancy, what should we be doing? I'll let you start it off, and then we'll go right down the line, 1 or 2 minutes each, and then turn it over to what I hope will be a patient bunch of lions waiting in the Coliseum here.
Thanks very much. I guess I set this up for myself, didn't I? Obviously, there are short-term and long-term solutions we want to deal with here. Right now, the situation that we're in, I believe, can only be resolved if we take care of the mortgage problem at its base. I do believe that there will be many, many more failures. And as long as those mortgages are on the and mortgage-backed securities are on the balance sheets of banks, we will have a weak and timid banking system. It will be very hard to get loans from banks. It will be very hard to have our economy grow, and we may end up having to continuously recapitalize banks. I happen to be a believer in the original idea of the TARP program. I thought that the right thing to do was to buy the assets from the banks, because if they continue to weaken after you've bought them, it's for the account of the government rather than the account of the banks. As long as they are weakening within the banks, we are just going to have to keep feeding feeding capital to those institutions, and that is a the wrong policy, and one that has almost an endless series of losses associated with it. So we need a standardized program, as I see it, to address the mortgage problem. We can't do it one at a time. We can't do it by applying new bankruptcy law provisions to mortgages. We have millions of them out there that are going to be problematic. We need a standardized program that will reform and refinance the mortgages that are weak and get those mortgages under control. And once that happens, once there is a floor under the housing market, I think we will start to see a recovery. Now, the long-term prospect is much, much more difficult in my mind because it gets into questions of housing policy and the things I talked to in my initial remarks. But one of the key questions here is how much the government is going to be involved in providing homes or allowing the expansion of home ownership in the United States. And as I said, we have been spending, from my point of view, we have been spending a lot of money on this. It's a worthwhile thing to do to expand home ownership, but it should not, if it's to be done, it should be done through a government program that is based on taxpayer funding, like most others, above board, ability to criticize it, and the risks that are taken and are taken by the government are taken currently. What we have done in the past through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and I think also through CRA, is to place those risks on the banking system or on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and ultimately created the problems that we have today. So if we're to do it, we should do it through some sort of subsidized, probably a subsidized down payment program. Thank you.
Get CRA straightened out. It's true, is it not, that that's applicable only to financial institutions with deposit insurance?
Yes.
All right. And I think we were told that they're therefore subject to safety and soundness regulation, the originators, right?
Correct.
So the loans originated by independent mortgage brokers and so on are not subject to CRA.
No.
So is CRA really a problem? Is that part of the problem here?
Yes. I think the fact that they are regulated and banks are required to make loans that are safe and sound doesn't mean the loans are actually safe and sound.
Okay,
and, in
yeah.
fact, the regulations that the Clinton administration adopted in 1993 essentially said to the banks, you shall make these loans, and you shall make them under the penalties we will prescribe. And if the loans are not good loans, they ought to at least be flexible, and we'll deal with the problems in the future. But that is, the loans were not all good loans.
John
and,
Taylor?
And yeah, the standards,
no, this is
the standards that you would use
look,
for these.
As long as AEI, they want to keep the CRA discussion in front of things because they don't want to focus on the malfeasance of the industry. Let's face it, it's the private sector that brought us here, the unregulated institutions, the people, most of whom have you know, gone under because of this malfeasance. But CRA loans actually perform at or better than most market, most non-CRA regulated, non-CRA loans.
Let me just put it to the audience.
2% less default rate.
Let me just put it to the audience this way. If those loans were going to be profitable loans for banks, you didn't need CRA.
No, that's not true. Because what happens is it's easier for a bank to, say, make a loan, I'll use a business example, to a million, a corporation that's looking for $10 million than to have 10 small businesses come in, each wanting $1 million. It is, in fact, a more profitable enterprise to do the higher end loan. But the law simply requires that you can't ignore creditworthy people who have the ability to pay on the mortgage just because they're lower on the economic spectrum. That's all it requires.
Well, it's interesting because the regulators look at CRA from three points, from lending, from service, and from investments. And the examiners look at the type of loans that are underwritten to the low and moderate income areas. And I can assure you those loans are expected to be underwritten in a safe and sound manner. And I advanced the notion to you that the most abusive loans are those loans that were sold into private label securitizations to make money, not to service the low and moderate income communities.
Yeah, on the CRA issue, I actually addressed this on this panel a few years ago here. And gone back and looked at the legislative history when the CRA was enacted, the CRA was premised on the idea that most bankers are dumb bigots. And there was no data developed to support that, because non-bigoted people aren't going to discriminate against minorities, women, what have you, and smart bigots are going to lend to anybody despite what their personal preferences are. And that's why I think what also concerns me about CRA is it's part of a broader policy, public policy emphasis of overstressing home ownership. And I think that that's what we have to back away from, is not sanctifying it quite as much as we have in the past, while at the same time asking homeowners to have more skin in the game so that they are, in fact, a genuine homeowner and not a renter disguised as a homeowner.
I'd like to explode that myth, too. And by the way, I want to point out that it takes six conservatives and libertarians to deal with one liberal. You know, this issue of homeownership. First off, you should know that these high-cost loans, these predatory loans, these loans that are toxic that Scott referred to, that's caused this market meltdown, have very little to do with new home ownership. In fact, less than 10% of the loans that were made in that period of time, 2003 to 2007, where these the worst of the loans occurred, had to do with helping or Clinton's initiatives or anyone's initiatives pushing people into home ownership. It had to do with existing homeowners getting bigger homes, and it had to do with refinances and home equity lines of credits and taking the equity out and using it for consumer spending, and the willingness of the private sector financial institutions, in particular mortgage companies, to be willing to put the cash on the table repeatedly and even offer them more than they were asking for. That's what that was about.
Do you have any data on loan problems of those with mortgages originated from supervised institutions versus others?
I've not seen data on that particular topic.
All right, well, you'll have to come back next year. Now, we'll take a brief interlude for a door prize. Anybody know what a ninja loan is?
No.
No income, no job or assets, right. Very good. Okay. You would think that would be a null set, but it's not a null set. Let's take our first question from Des Moines. Caller?
Actually, I'm from Texas. I'd like the panel to focus more on structural and procedural reforms that could deal with the larger problem in the long term. What we have seem to have is not just a mortgage bubble, but a standard of living bubble, a super bubble, as it were, that we've seen in the tech bubble, in the even going back to the savings and loan crisis of the 80s. And I've watched it through my life, and I've observed certain fundamental underlying causes. Milton Friedman once said that he was in favor of free markets, but not of large organizations. And Alan Greenspan seemed to have been shocked by the discovery that decision makers in this field are not unitary decision makers. They are aggregates of individuals, echelons, departments, and interdependent, codependent networks that often operate in conflict with one another. This is the so-called agency problem. And I've observed, especially in larger organizations, how middle or management can decide to its own benefit in ways that are contrary to the interests of the shareholders. So what I would like to propose, and for your consideration, is to revive the traditional grand jury system, to engage in freewheeling investigations of any organization or network of organizations that is too big to fail or too well connected to fail, that would not be so much trying to decide if they satisfy certain cut and dried accounting standards, to Sarbanes-Oxley, but we would be free to inquire among anyone who might know, including the lower level employees or what anyone doing business with them, whether there are any problems they can foresee due to such conflicts of interest, and to do nothing else but bring them forward so that they can be exposed to view by everybody who is concerned.
All right, let me ask if there's anyone here that wants to comment.
Could you repeat the question?
Todd.
I'll just say one thing, which is... One of the reasons, one of the things that sort of bugs me about the way this has played out is that it's played out against the backdrop of an election season. And I think one of the things that happened is that everybody just has run around looking for scapegoats and partial stories. Look, lenders defrauded borrowers, borrowers defrauded lenders, Wall Street screwed up, government policies were bad, monetary policy was bad. I mean, this was a perfect storm of people screwing things up. I think some theories are more plausible than others, but you know, I think the big thing is trying to get in and look at all the various things that were going on, and it's not just a matter of poor hapless borrowers getting screwed by lenders or lenders getting screwed by borrowers or all these different sorts of things. There's a lot of things that came together here, and I think if any of the bits of pieces had not gone as bad as they had, I don't think this would have been quite as bad as it is. I do think one big issue, and John Taylor referred to this and some of the other guys referred to it, is I think that the rating agencies do in fact play an unusually pivotal nasty part in this, because as the rating agencies who were willing to, you know, Moody's, Standard and Fitch and Poor's, who slapped AAA ratings on this, allowed this stuff to kind of get out of its cage, you know, such that people say, you know, a condominium gets foreclosed in Florida and Iceland's economy fails, right? I mean, I think that's the piece that turns it from a disaster to a catastrophe, if there's any piece.
Just follow up on that a little bit. I think we have to also have to realize that not only are there multiple causes and interconnected causes, but a lot of the roots of this go back many decades. The more I look at it, for instance, I see the 1986 Tax Act and its restriction on interest deduction to only interest on home mortgages as an underlying cause, because after that point in time, we saw a tremendous increase in indebtedness on homes, and also perhaps only coincidentally, from 1986 until the present, the U.S. went from a slight creditor nation to the rest of the world to being in hock on a net basis to the rest of the world by the tune of about $2.5 trillion, which gets back to the point that Scott Polakoff made about the negative savings rate. We have to drill way deep down and go way back in time to see the causes that change the incentives that have gotten us to the point where we are, yeah, that created the environment for the perfect storm.
Yeah. Alex, briefly. On the metaphor of the perfect storm, I was at a meeting the other day where that was much used, and people kept referring to the 100-year storm. And my comment is the problem with 100-year storms in financial systems is they happen every 20 years.
Other from the audience.
I've heard two points that don't seem to square with each other. In John's case, apparently, he tells us, and to my relief, that this is really an upper-middle-class problem, that all the minority and low-income loans are fine under CRA, so at least we're not going to have a class or race dimension to this argument. And I think what he really means to say is that all the evil mortgage-backed securities who lent to low and minorities were not servicing them but taking advantage of them, which just goes to the question of whether those loans should have been made at all, which at least Barney Frank admitted last week.
The CRA loans are fine. It's the non-CRA loans to minorities
that are not fine, just to be clear. Yeah.
Okay.
I believe, John, that what you said was that those other loans, or it may have been another panelist, were not made in service of those communities. So either one has to logically say that they weren't made to low-income and minority people, or that these were loans made to those communities who could people who could not qualify for CRA loans. Or there is no minority or low-income dimension here.
Well, the majority of loans, by the way, that we're talking about that are now toxic, having problems, are to white people and to middle-income people.
Well, the majority, that's hardly surprising. The question is whether it's disproportionate.
It is disproportionate.
But I'm sorry, I didn't really mean to. Peter's point, I want to take on the right.
There's a clarification, John. Say it again.
Sorry.
No, I was saying it is disproportionate that communities were targeted by the subprime non-CRA lenders. So there's a disproportionate compared to their percentage of the population.
Disproportionate.
But still, borrowings
by minority communities.
By minority. Okay. Yeah.
Peter, I wanted to take on, because you say, much as Sheila Bair, actually, that it's that it would be far too complicated to handle this all through bankruptcy, but instead, in a sense, it has to be handled through perhaps a bureaucratic mechanism of the government buying all these securities and deciding how to readjust them. That, to me, simply seems to be a kind of bureaucratic burden shifting. It seems to me that bankruptcy is exactly the existing non-ex post facto way that is constitutionally considered to address these problems. And so I placed myself as someone for Ocean State Policy who's proposed that we take a more small claims court approach to bankruptcy and that we accept that we have a system for dealing with this. Let government set the forum and not the solution.
Right, let me point out that's the first person to have used the B word.
Yeah.
Peter?
I understand the argument about bankruptcy. I just don't believe that with millions of mortgages in trouble, you can handle it through the court system. The court system is already clogged, and putting it into the bankruptcy courts or bankruptcy masters throughout the country would take much too much time to straighten out the serious problems we have in the banking system. That's my principal problem there.
I think at a macro level, they're saying all debt is repaid either by the borrower or the lender. And what actually has to happen was private sector has to delever. Corporate-wise, that'll happen pretty quickly. Consumer-wise, it's much harder. Deflation is immoral. It allows people to get rich by avoiding commerce. We need to have 5, 6, 7, 8% inflation for 4 or 5 years, which will delever the consumer by 40 or 50%, with the Fed watching very carefully net credit creation, and net outstanding credit should not be allowed to rise during that period, so that the consumer can delever, and in one manner or another, loans are going to be repaid by some mix between the borrower and the lender, and a little targeted inflation for the next few years is, I think, the best sort of solution.
One minute history lesson. In the 1870s, in the panic of 1873, I think it was, the railroads, which had been recently built and highly leveraged, into the West, the railroads built into the West, were almost uniformly in default and bankruptcy. And the similarity with the current situation is not great, but it has this in common. It was absolutely essential that the railroads continued to run because the crops had to come in or they would spoil in the fields. The people in the East who eat and the people in the West who grow were totally interdependent and linked by those railroads. And the bankruptcy courts did step in. They invented something called receiver's certificates. They issued debt that was senior to all of the debt on the books. And they took these huge reorganizations through over a period of years reasonably successfully. This is not the same situation. Whether bankruptcy courts would be up to it now, I don't know. It's so international. There's so many players. But it's not the first time this kind of a challenge has arisen.
Can I just speak to the big bankruptcy issue that's going on right now is whether or not bankruptcy judges will be allowed to cram down or strip down mortgages in bankruptcy, which is basically if your house is worth less than is owed under current law, and it's always been the law, you are not allowed if you want to keep your house, you have to pay the note as written. You can't write down the value of the mortgage to the value of the property. One of the proposals that's on the table is to allow them to do that, as well as allowing judges to adjust the interest rate. That's what Peter was referring to. Now, there's a couple things I think are interesting about this, which is, first, it would be a dramatic change in law that's never been allowed. Secondly, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Obviously, that's going to increase the risk of lending, and it's going to increase interest rates going forward for future borrowers, especially for those who are most likely to file bankruptcy, right? Third, there's a question about the extent to which that is needed, because for various reasons I won't go into, it turns out that there's an ability to already strip off home equity loans that are completely underwater, which I think takes care of some of the problems, at least with some of the houses, that doesn't require any change in the law. And interestingly enough, for some reason we don't understand, homeowners who have the same LTV are more likely to default, which is, you know, if they, you know, the amount they owe versus home, are more likely to default if they've got a home equity loan than if it's the same LTV on just a purchase money loan.
That's loan to value, right?
Loan to value, right.
Not Ling Temco Boy.
That's right. Right. But the final point on the cram down point is what the concern I think it shows, my concern with respect to Congress, is that it looks like something free, right? One of the problems we've done with the bailout is we've painted ourselves in a corner, which is it's so darn expensive and only moderately effective at best, that it forecloses other options because we've got less money to do other options. So my concern is that Congress is now looking around for sort of less systematic systems for trying to do things that they don't have to pay for, and they're looking at cram down as one of these options. I'm not convinced that it's a good option. Why? Because, number one, it only addresses some loans. Number two, I think it does. It's going to create real incentives for people to file bankruptcy because it's going to allow them to strip down loans and then keep the value when it goes up on the back end. And third, it's going to drag in a lot of non-mortgage debt along with it, credit card debt, car loans, all those sorts of things are going to get dragged in. And if it's a mortgage problem, come up with a mortgage solution. Don't come up with a bankruptcy solution to what's a mortgage problem. I think that this is a real Pandora's box that they're potentially opening if they allow cram down of home mortgages.
All right, we're going to take a very brief comment from Bert, then back to the floor for the next person who will bring in a new subject.
Two things we have to realize. First of all, the Fed can't create inflation. That, I think, is a pipe dream. The second thing is home prices are still not bottom. And I think that when this is the experience of the 80s down in the Southwest, we have to let home prices hit a floor and then with that have the ownership of homes shift into the hands of those who are willing owners of these homes. Frankly, there are a lot of people in homes that face foreclosure that, frankly, would be better off personally if they were out of the home, didn't own it any longer, and I'm not sure we're doing them a great service, but trying to keep them into a home that they would just as soon be better off not owning. So we need to have the market clear, and then we will start to see the recovery in housing prices.
Thank you. Next topic.
Emil Arkath from the New York City chapter. I do, in fact, have...
Louder.
Emil Arkath from the New York City chapter. I do, in fact, have a new topic. It was just alluded to at the very end of Mr. Polakoff's comments, and that is the incredibly destructive effect that fair value accounting has had on the financial system. And it just seems incredible that... we're in month 16 of the crisis, and the SEC still has a task force looking at that. About a month and a half ago, we got clarifications that dealt with the worst aspects of fair value mark-to-market accounting. But, of course, they're all discretionary and have come 16 months too late. Once the toothpaste is out of the tube, it's hard to imagine anyone having the nerve to take a litigation risk of writing assets back up. But, you know, now that I think we've discovered that this was a colossal mistake, I guess the question is, what do we do going forward? Because it seems like it's been enormously destructive to the system.
Scott?
I really disagree with the questioner. I think one serious aspect of the problem was a year ago, and I wrote about it, Merrill and other financial institutions were lying. At that point, they were solvent. If they had sort of told, I believe they were solvent. If they had sort of told the truth, they could have raised capital, gone on as ongoing concerns. It was their opacity and dishonesty that was majorly confounded the problem. I think there are two different points. There are two standard definitions of solvency. One is your ability to pay bills as they come due, which should be the sort of operant definition that we use. And under that definition, certainly when they could always when they had access to the Treasury, Fannie and Freddie were solvent, and they had. And they actually had incredibly valuable businesses. The other definition of solvency is the value of your assets is exceeding your liabilities. I mean, that's operantly in terms of handling institutions and pressures. We want to use the first definition of solvency and not the second. But we do want to actually know what financial what the fair value of everybody's balance sheet
is.
Scott, did you have a comment?
I have three concerns with fair value accounting, and Andy makes some really good points. I guess number one, we're in an environment where we're marking to model right now. No, there is no market for many of these instruments, and that concerns me. Number two, we're not effectively marking the entire balance sheet. So there's certain parts of the liability side of the balance sheet that we're not marking that actually could have premiums associated with them. And number three, it's very pro-cyclical. And pro-cyclicality in this environment is troubling. I think it's the notion that you simply can't have too much transparency. It's not understood by the investors, and it's absolutely not understood by the consumers who are doing business with the financial institutions.
Peter.
I agree with the comment that was made by the questioner. Fair value accounting has, I think, been very destructive simply because there has not been an active market on which to base the mark-to-market judgments that are made. But I would mention one thing, and that is that Citibank announced, I think, 3 days ago, that it was going to use, I think, the clarification, which I think was actually a reversal by the SEC that was made on September 30, and it was going to move many of its assets into held to maturity accounts and from trading into held for sale, which is the
second. So it doesn't have to mark them down to current market.
So it doesn't have to mark them down to current market as it would with trading assets, and it would to some extent also with its held for sale assets. In addition, and this is even more important, under the IASB, that is the International Accounting Standards Board's rules, they're the equivalent for Europe of GAAP here in the, and the FASB here in the United States. They allowed banks to do that sometime in early September. And, in fact, in its financial statements after September 30, Deutsche Bank did that, moved many of its assets into the held-to-maturity category, and its stock price rose 18% when it did it. So there is a, in other words, investors will understand that the way assets have been marked, they are marked excessively down because of this mark-to-market idea, and they will not rebel against it and say this is lying or this is management manipulation.
Well, let me ask you this, Peter. Since the value of the asset and the asset itself don't change regardless of the accounting, is it that investors are somehow mesmerized by the accounting, or is it that the change in accounting is more assurance against government intervention?
Oh, I don't know if it's that it's the latter. I think actually the assets, we don't know what the assets are worth. And if you were going to look at one index, which is the market price, that could be a misleading index. The best index for determining what assets are worth is what their cash flows are. Right. And someone has to go in and look at the cash flows and value it based on discounting those cash flows. That's not what we've been doing. We have been expecting investors in the market who know nothing about the cash flows of these particular assets and are scared to death about what is in these portfolios to make a judgment about what these things are worth.
But they don't know any more when the bank switches the accounting, right?
Well, I think what happens, the only way you can interpret what happened with Deutsche Bank is that the market, the investors, actually did think that the assets had been written down too far. We don't know which ones or how many, but they did think it was true. And when it was possible for Deutsche Bank to move some of these into a different category where they wouldn't be judged by market prices, the bank looked healthier, and investors gave them credit for that.
I'm still mystified. If the bank seems to be undervaluing its assets, that looks like an investment opportunity for me, unless it might be a trigger for the government to liquidate the bank.
It could be, in fact, an investment opportunity for people, and people have hoped to do that. But as long as you follow mark-to-market accounting, the assets are going to continue to decline in value in the market because the sales that are going on are, by and large, liquidation sales, people who are forced to sell or distress sales, and without any buyers, the people who are picking them up are vultures at very low levels. So there's a spiraling down.
If I could add, one of the key reasons we have this problem is due to maturity mismatch of assets that are being funded with relatively short-term liabilities. If if an institution feels it that the market is just being too harsh in its valuation, then what it should do in the interest of its stockholders is to hang on to those assets, ride through the price depression. But in order to do that, it has to have the liquidity in place. So it's not just a matter of shifting assets from available for sale to hold to maturity, but having the financing in place to be able to hold them to maturity. And what I hope comes out of all of the revision that's going to go on in terms of how financial institutions are regulated and accounted for is that there will be a greater recognition of the need to reduce maturity mismatching, which in turn will reduce a lot of these accounting problems.
Andrew, briefly, and then back to the floor.
Yeah, I think there's no market is very often used as a crutch. There's a bid for every asset in the world. There can be very wide bid-ask spreads. There can be prices that you don't like, but there is a price at which you can sell everything. And it really comes down to, again, sort of the second definition of insolvency. I think people are entitled to know what the fair market, what the bid is, what the offer is, what sort of the fair market value of something is. But we don't want assets being seized and the dead weight loss of transfer and so forth if an entity can meet its bills in the ongoing course of events, which is sort of a cash flow number. It really is sort of not seizing assets from people that are insolvent on a fair market value that can pay their bills.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Bradley Gafford. I was just wondering what the panel thought can and should be done to fix the incentives and competence of the rating agency triopoly.
Of the rating agency triopoly, okay.
Rating agencies... at least among the top two, or of course, I wouldn't call it a triopoly. Many people have pointed out it's a shared monopoly because you need two ratings typically, so you don't even have to compete. I think one of the this is a very important topic. The rating agencies are clearly in a central point in the whole unfortunate story of the bubble. The reason they're there is a set of government actions by the SEC and many other regulators to enshrine ratings from particularly designated rating agencies as regulatory requirements. These even got put into the so-called Basel II capital rules. And so this set of regulations did was create a concentrated point of failure. In thinking about the design of any system, you may wish to avoid concentrated points of failure, and the rating agencies became exactly such a point in the mortgage market. Many people have pointed out that a rating agency which works for investors should have a better incentive structure than rating agencies which work for the issuers of securities. I think that's a fair point. And I think we ought to create and encourage rating agencies which are paid solely by and owe their duties solely to the buyers of securities as opposed to the sellers of securities in every way we can.
Sounds like a business opportunity also.
John Taylor? Wouldn't that create a free rider problem?
I don't say that you have to give your ratings to everybody, just people who pay for them.
All right.
John Taylor.
Yeah, I was actually going to make that last point that Alex made, but also say that I think that we have to find a way for these agencies to have a due diligence standard. In meeting with them and talking with them about how this happened, invariably I get to a conversation where they'd sit back and they'd say, we're not a due diligence agency. And I would always go, really? Did you know that most people think you are? Because you see that AAA rating or whatever the rating is, and you assume that what's happened is that they've verified the information they've received from the people who are paying them, again, Alex's point, but they don't. They go on face value of what they're receiving, and they're emphatic about not doing due diligence, and I think that has to change.
Bert, go ahead, please.
Just didn't go back to the point that I made during my opening remarks. They have a First Amendment protection which effectively protects them against negligence. And when they're paid by the issuer, they become part of the underwriting process. I would suggest to you that if the rain agencies could be sued for negligence where they've been paid by the issuer, they would be much more conservative in terms of ratings they give out. And I don't think they would rate, even bother to rate or try to rate these very complex securities that are very much part of the problem. Again, why should they be exempt in a way that the CPA firms are not when they give opinions on financial statements that have been and where they've been paid by the issuer of the financial statements?
I'm really troubled by the free rider problem that you mentioned, because if an issuer seller pays the rating agency, and that's obviously a problem, but if the buyer pays the agency, anyone else can come in and buy the same securities and hasn't paid. And so there is a disincentive on the part of the buyer to hire a rating agency to do it, because that buyer is paying for everyone else. So it's a very tough problem, and I've never been able to come to a satisfactory solution. The only thing that seems to make sense to me is to require the rating agency to acquire some of the assets, some of the securities that are being sold, and hold those securities.
Well, Peter, Alex's response was that they didn't have to publish what they rated.
Yeah, but if you know someone's buying, you know that there's probably a rating behind it, and those things leak out in any event. I agree with Alex from that point of view, but it's just very hard to keep that kind of information confidential.
I just want to add, we shouldn't leave out of the equation just simple error in a lot of this. I think that a lot of people on Wall Street did bad things, but a lot of them, I think, were just making mistakes, extrapolating from a long history of how houses behave in the prime market to a whole set of new borrowers in the subprime market and all these sorts of things. And I think, to some extent, they may have just had bad models that they were dealing with that people are going to are going to learn from. And so we do need to divide out bad incentives from just mistakes in thinking about these questions.
Liz, do we go to two? Okay, 4 minutes left. Go ahead, Alex.
Quote, error is more formidable than fraud. The losses to which a plausible manager in complete good faith would commit a bank are beyond comparison greater than those which the dishonest manager would strive to conceal, unquote, Walter Badgett, 1873.
That was the same year, 1873. Okay, we're narrowing the focus now. Okay, last question from the floor.
As far as the prescription goes, Peter Wallace has come out recommending acquiring troubled assets. I'd like the remainder of the panel to comment on the desirability of that approach versus the approach that has been followed so far, which is injecting capital into selected troubled institutions. In that context, if you could also comment on the objection voiced by some, namely that many of these so-called toxic mortgages have been sliced and diced and securitized and pooled to an extent that makes it infeasible to reacquire them.
John? Thank you for asking that question, because for me, one of the most significant things that's been said here today is something that Peter said, and also gives me an unusual opportunity to agree with something that someone from AEI has said. So I want to say that if AEI and NCRC and a whole bunch of other folks are saying we've got to stop the bleeding, we're looking at somewhere between 5 and 7 million more toxic mortgages that if we don't do something, we're going to continue to see it undermine Wall Street securities and our economy as a whole. So there's just the most immediate thing, beyond all the other things we've been talking about, is we've got to come up with a solution. And unfortunately, what's been offered, these voluntary solutions, Hope for Homeowners, in the first 2 months of its existence, has done 86 loans. I don't know if I need to say that again, but the point is...
Yes, who was that? Did they do those loans?
And, you know, it's simply, even within the own administration, you can tell there's a lot of disagreement. And God bless Sheila Beer, because she's had the courage to stand up and say, we really need to do something more substantive. But unfortunately, you know, it looks like this thing is going to be punted to the next administration. That's going to be 2 more months of increased foreclosure filings. This past month, we had 240,000 mortgage foreclosure filings, and that's the 34th consecutive increase of the previous month from the previous year. So in other words, nothing that's happened now has slowed down the mortgage foreclosure crisis. It continues to grow. We're looking at, in the next year alone, 2.5, and this is Paulson and Bernanke, not me, 2 to 2.5 million more foreclosures. I mean, that's more than we've had already. And it's like, if we don't get ahead of this problem and find a way, and your issue of how do we get these loans that have been sliced and diced, they still all have the same loan number, right? So you can track them, right? But there's no question about it that something inordinate needs to happen, and it seems to me there are two remedies immediately available. One is the reverse auction. The other is what's been proffered by Professor Johnson from Harvard, who suggested that we use the eminent domain statute to acquire these and perhaps pay something more than fair market value, whatever that is. We had that discussion, but whatever the fair market value is, perhaps pay more of that to sweeten it for the investors and work with the servicing banks to get them to understand this is the best deal you're going to see in perhaps many years. But to acquire those loans so we no longer have to sit there waiting for voluntary action or waiting for one investor to move while the other one sits there, waits for that investor to move because they think that will turn the market. We've got to grab these loans, get ahead of it, create the bottom, the floor in this foreclosure crisis, and have meaningful modifications that are going to keep people who are working still able to pay on the loans, the new subset of folks that Alex Pollock identified, of people who are not lost their job, not divorced, not in ill health, but are still working at the same income, whose loans are putting them underwater. Get to those folks, get them the kind of mortgages they should have had in the first place, and work with the industry, the private sector, as well as the government, and the government can recoup whatever it puts into this over a period of time. If we don't do that and do that on a grand scale, as Peter said, then we're going to continue to have this devastating pull down on the economy that's going to hurt every other effort.
Did I hear a bell? It's our time has run with three or four people who on the panel who wanted to say something. We had more questions from the audience. Maybe you all can get together by coming forward if someone doesn't throw us out of the room. Please join me in thanking the panel.